you know, again, skinny stranger in a town I'd never been to in my life, and starting a new school, and these people I couldn't talk to, and my brother who was also like an alien to me. And I came up and I was like, man, this is magic. And I remember this day very clearly deciding, this is magic I want to be a part of. I'm going to be a writer.
What if story is the answer to our crises of meaning and belonging, to our impulse to heal our lives and help others, to our desire and drive to leave this world better than we found it? Now, we love good stories. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. Not just with the stories themselves, but with the stories behind the stories. Their oddly perfect timing, the healing process they provoke in their authors, and their capacity to catalyze individual and collective change. And we love exploring these with writers, thought leaders, entrepreneurs, healers, parents, and others. Tune in to hear these stories behind the stories and entertain with us the real possibility that whether you are a teller or a consumer, story is always offering or leading us to an answer. At 10 years old, Griff found his calling when a book transported him out of his challenging childhood for just a few hours. Determined to be part of the magic that made that possible for him, he took on the identity of writer and has spent the last 40 plus years wrestling with that identity and all that seems to come with it. Tune in to hear how Griff was saved by story, literally offered a path and an identity that buoyed him through an unpredictable and awkward childhood. You'll find out how he created his own rite of passage and changed his relationship to that identity in his life, how he's navigated and learned from various forms of writing, including short stories and screenplays and more, and how he's become masterful at writing relationship dynamics and love stories. And of course, you'll hear that he'll have to join us again because we just didn't have enough time with the guy. All right, it's time. Grab a cup of something delicious and enjoy these sips of story and sanity with us. Welcome to Sips of Story and Sanity, where we talk about the stories behind the great stories with authors, speakers, thought leaders, healers, and more. My team, son Aaron.
Hi.
My sister Alyssa.
Hello.
And clients turned friends turned team members, Teddy.
Hi, y'all.
And Lori.
Hey, everyone.
They're all here to help me make sure that we get the most delicious sips of story and sanity out of this experience. And today is going to be a lot of fun. This is our first interview that we have done with someone who hasn't at all actually been part of our community of writers. And so we have some really good questions because Griff, Roy Griff Griffiths, what are we going to call you today?
Griff, please.
Okay. Calls himself a storyteller for a lot of reasons. He decided to be a writer when he was 10 and never looked back. Along the way, he's done all the usual starving artist jobs, janitor, waiter, bookstore clerk, and a few unusual ones. He was the 62nd aviation rescue swimmer in U.S. Coast Guard. He doesn't just write action adventure, he lived a little of it himself. He's written poetry, plays, and screenplays. He's also the author of 12 novels, including the epic historical fiction saga, By the Hands of Men, and the alternative history series, The Lonesome George Chronicles, as well as the comic fantasy, oh no, how do I say that?
Cthulhu.
Cthulhu, Amalgamated Cycle. In 2018, he received the John Millis Screenwriting Award for his original film script, Cold Day in Hell. Well, first of all those titles just make me want to carve out a month of my life and go dive into your writing. So the way that we know Griff is that people have heard this story over and over in my community, that there was this mysterious woman who asked me this really awful question about 15 years ago. And it was, what value do you have to give to the world today? And it was an awful question because I was completely unprepared. I had no idea what I was supposed to be doing. So really, this is the husband of the woman who's responsible for all of this mess. Really, she started it. And so for the last 15 years, I've been hearing her talk about this amazing writer that she is married to and all of his success as a writer. And so, of course, you know, we had to have you on the show and hear about your process. So over here at True to Intention, we have done mostly nonfiction, although in the last few years, we have started working on fiction from the beginning. And that has been really fun. So I'm excited to hear a little bit about, or a lot about, your process and what that has been like. So let's start at the beginning. You said this happened at 10?
Yep.
What happened? Yeah, what was it like?
First off, can everybody hear me? I'm just talking to my webcam. Let's see. How do I make this brief but poignant? You know, everybody's got a story from their child story. There's that word. Everybody's got the story from their childhood. You know, we all get wounded in our own ways. My case, you know, my dad was an alcoholic. Just a family thing. He was like running moonshine when he was 15. But he also decided to change his story and join the Air Force. So I moved around a lot as a kid, kind of an introvert, and I picked up reading early. I discovered the escape reading can provide. But I didn't really appreciate it until there was some family trouble during the Vietnam War. And my brother and I got shipped off to my grandparents' house in Tucson, Arizona. So the parents could sort of figure out what was going on with their lives without us underfoot. And as a parent now, I can kind of understand the need to do that. But at the time, I was like this lonely kid, felt like a stranger everywhere. Didn't really know my grandparents very well. You know, nice people, but effectively strangers to me. My brother and I, very different individuals. And when I was trying to talk to him about how weird all this felt to me in good dysfunctional family manner, he said, I don't want to talk about it. So I was all adrift. But I just happened to wander into this used bookstore back when, you know, you could find them everywhere. It was in a little strip mall. And somebody, I was just looking for probably comic books, but somebody had turned in a bunch of Edgar Rice Burroughs books. Now, for the younger viewers, Edgar Rice Burroughs was the guy who created Tarzan, you know, right around the turn of the century, 1910, 1912. And it took off. It took the world by storm. Well, his first novel had been something called A Princess of Mars, which they made into the movie John Carter of Mars. But I knew the name because one of the things my father and I would manage to do was we would watch old black and white movies on Saturday morning and love the Tarzan movies. And he was the one who told me they were written by a guy named Edgar Rice Burroughs. And that was probably the first time I understand, oh, wait, people create these. They don't just, you know, leap into being all by themselves. So I saw the name Edgar Rice Burroughs, and I already knew I kind of liked science fiction-y movies. So you know, I had a couple quarters in my pocket, and I bought the first book. And then I pedaled my, you know, my little 10-speed back to this house where I feel like a stranger, you know, like a hostage. And I started reading the book. And like, you know, 9 hours later, I come back from Mars a changed man because I just like fell into this book and it transported me. It took me away from, you know, again, skinny stranger in a town I'd never been to in my life and starting a new school and these people I couldn't talk to and my brother who was also like an alien to me. And I came up and I was like, man, this is magic. And I remember this date very clearly deciding this is magic I want to be a part of. I'm going to be a writer. And that was it.
Wow.
You know, I joined the cult right there and never looked back.
So what were the first few things that you started to write? What was your path?
They were heinous is what they were. Actually, probably after that, I'd say seventh grade, I started writing basically, a fan fiction sort of version of an Edgar Rice Burroughs type story. And it was handwritten. It was horrible. But I learned that I actually started writing when I was about seven. I found cleaning out my grandmother's house after she died, there was a story I'd written in second grade, something about, I don't know, the coyotes on the hill and being one of them. Where I got that, I don't know, but apparently I was telling stories well before then. That was kind of the first stuff I did. And I just started writing short stories. I wrote a lot of stuff and it got better. Unfortunately, many of those are lost to history, so we don't have to go over that. But at the time, and this was, early 70s, there were still magazines being published, and there wasn't a lot of information about, how do you make a living as a writer. What little I picked up on was what the old pulp writers from the 30s and 40s, Ray Bradbury and those kind of fantastic writers, because I like that. I like the escape, the otherworldliness. It was, you type it up, you put it in an envelope, and you send it to a publisher with an envelope inside so they can send it back if they don't like it. So I was doing that. But I just kept writing because I think it helped me. It probably helped me make sense of things a little bit, but also it kind of gave me an identity. Since I was a quiet kid and we moved so much and, I didn't do athletics. I was just kind of like this guy who read. I read books and wrote stories. And, that worked for a while, but then it stopped working.
Yeah. Okay. So you've decided to be a career writer, started to do all the things that they tell everyone to do, write, mm-hmm. send, mm-hmm. wait. So at what point were you thinking, like, maybe this isn't going to work out? Like, was there a phase where you just thought maybe, we call it upside down here, but was there a point where you ever doubted this part of your journey, or did you just know that it was going to happen at some point?
Oh, no, there was a lot of doubt. One of the problems was I was, this is sort of a larger life story. I was telling myself a lot of lies, and I didn't realize that. Like I said, the writing gave me an identity because I didn't feel known or seen or anything like that, kind of up to that point. I put a lot of weight on I'm a writer. And along with that came the other lies, which were something like, if I'm not a successful writer, undefined what success means, I'm nothing. Mm. So of course, every rejection slip I got was, another whack from the karmic sledgehammer driving me deeper into despair. That was one way I was making myself crazy, because I really I liked writing and I still do. But even then, it was, part of it was fun. Just a lot of it was, how much would I surprise myself with the stuff I would come up with? Mm-hmm.
Out of like every 80, 90 rejection slips, you get a note on one saying, hey, good story, not right for me or whatever. And then maybe I'd be a runner up in a contest or something. There'd be just enough. It was just like the mouse in the maze. Hey, there's another crumb. I'm going for it, kind of thing. Then I started finding other outlets. I was in community theater. I was kind of a drama geek in high school. So I found these other outlets. It's like, well, hey, there's a one-act play festival. Why don't I write a one-act play? I've read several, so and it won because there was no competition. But hey, it's a win. So I started writing those, and you know, and that I gotta say, having a live audience is a really nice a nice bit of approbation that you can get. They'll sure tell you what works and what doesn't, just great. You know, like that, right? And meanwhile, that's when I had my first midlife crisis, when I was about 25. Because I'd been, you know, knocking myself out on the writing. You know, got a tiny bit of traction with the one act plays. But I was divorced. Hadn't been to college yet. I'd won like at least one national writing award at that time. I couldn't get a college scholarship off of it. I thought, wait a minute, this is like the thing. But meanwhile, they're saying, but there is a baton twirling scholarship. I'm like thinking, man, I've wasted my life. Oh. I made some bad choices. I'd actually been in the Coast Guard already at that point, doing electronics just because I got good scores. I was kind of clueless because this is the one constant is I really have written whatever else I've done, I've written. So a lot of these, you know, my scattered resume, it looks like it was written by somebody with Tourette's. It was simply about paying the bills, not being a burden on society, and, you know, having food for the cats or whatever. So I did the Coast Guard and I went to electronics with no interest in it, but I had no better plan, really. I just had to make a change at the time. So I'm 25, divorced, and I'm looking at all my life going, damn, there's a lot I wish I could do over. Like, I wish I could have, like, straightened out that marriage, but that's all on me, totally. About the only thing I realized I could do over was maybe go back in the Coast Guard and do what you go in the Coast Guard for, because my first 4 years I'd sort of like typed travel orders and answered phones and stuff like that. So talking about stories, I said, well, gosh, I guess I want to go back in the Coast Guard and I want to find out what I'm made of. And I was looking for a rite of passage, but I didn't have that term at the time. I didn't understand. Richard Bach talks about you have a problem because you need its gifts. Mm. And, I at the time I was pretty disgruntled about the fact I moved around every 2.5-3 years. And I felt like all I had in my life were places I'd left, you know, no place that was a home or anything like that. But, whatever else it gave me. But I said, yeah, I think I need to do this and find out. So I was going to go back in and be a what they call bosun's mate. And they tell terrible jokes about bosun's mates because they like paint things. But they also drive the small boats that go into the surf, you know, and let you rescue people. And I thought, well, this is going to be a good test myself. And again, what I was getting to was if I'd stayed in one place, maybe if I'd grown up in one place, maybe that rite of passage would have been different for me. It would have been, you know, okay, we're going to go steal the cows from, you know, farmer's house, and we're going to put them on the roof or whatever it is. But, you know, there was something that was missing, some closure I needed to give me that bridge between, you know, today I'm a man or something like that, you know? Can you stop me anytime if I'm rambling? I'm just, you know, I have my
car. No, this is important stuff. I mean, you're talking about, I love it. The continue, please. Okay, cool.
So I rejoined the Coast Guard. They say, man, you were an electronics guy. We can promote you. We can give you a bonus. I'm like, nah, you don't get it, man. Put me on a boat. I'm just going to do the boat thing. I was living on a 82-foot patrol boat, and I still had my little like typewriter, old school portable typewriter. Some of you guys know what they look like, right? Mm-hmm. The brown hard case. It took up a fifth of the locker I had on the on the boat, right? But I had to have it because I was still writing plays and stuff. I was, mm-hmm. I was still doing that. And then the rescue swimmer program came up. It was a new program. And I went, I'm reading about it. You know, and they're like, well, it's second toughest school in the Navy, and I said, hey, that sounds like a challenge I need. So I went, and it sucked, you know, because I was a drama geek, skinny little drama geek, had not played sports at school. In fact, I didn't really learn to throw a a softball even until I joined the Coast Guard at 22. I mean, that was how completely out of that, that's where I was. But I said I wanted to do this challenge, and you know, waiting to go to the school, I joined a YMCA, I started swimming, and I was running and, you know, doing whatever I could to get ready. So I went to the school, got sick in the middle, and they rolled me back to the next class. So it became like a, instead of a 6-week class, it was more like a 12-week class. And I was on a Navy base because it was such a new program, the Coast Guard didn't have their own school. And they were just borrowing the idea of the Navy rescue swimmers. They fly in helicopters around aircraft carriers. They're just like doing this while the planes are taking off. So if somebody punches out, they fly over and grab them. So we were getting guys out of pools wearing parachutes and big harnesses and stuff. And it was tough, but it taught me a lot that I wouldn't have realized about myself otherwise. And it taught me a lot about how to get through things. Mostly it taught me how much of it was in your head.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it was very physical. But at the same time, it was a lot of it was mental. And it was there were some really interesting experiences. We had guys there who were football players and, you know, some tough dudes. And in some of our drills, we're swimming around at night in the pool with our eyes closed, our hands, you know, tucked behind our back in their shorts. And it was a very strange thing to be doing that. First, you're waiting for people to jump, you know, jump on you from out of the water to make sure you can, you know, do your release and your controls. But so that was bad enough. You're like, oh, okay, when are they going to jump on me? But then to hear one of these big guys, you know, because again, I'm this scrawny 180-pound guy, hear these big football players screaming in terror in the dark because there was something about that experience mentally they didn't like. One guy bit an instructor to get away. And it was just, yeah, it was just a really interesting experience. And I came out the other side of that with a completely different story I told myself about who I was. And that changed my life. That was my rite of passage. And it, like I said, it taught me so much. It taught me how much of it's mental. So much it was mental. You know, your head would quit before your body would. So that was one lesson I hadn't learned in my young life. And it impressed on me a lot. And then, you know, the value of discipline and stuff. But I think the biggest thing was it suddenly changed the story I told myself about who I was and what I was capable of. And that's where I started to, you know, I didn't articulate it for decades, but that's where I started to kind of clue in that if you change your story, as in the story of who you are, I am, change your life. And I believe that because it happened to me.
Wow. So how did that rite of passage affect your writing? Did you notice anything different about the creative process or your reactions when you would get rejection letters, or how did that change your experience as a writer?
I think it lessened the sting. It started to lessen the sting because prior, you know, I thought that's all I had, that's all I was. You know, if my name wasn't on a magazine or a book cover, then that's just nothing. And you know, going through the, you know, that rescue swimmer school, and I was actually very fortunate. I went to San Francisco, at the time it was one of the very few active rescue swimmer stations because the program was so new, they didn't have enough training to go around. I went to one that was actually live, so I actually I was an active duty rescue swimmer when a lot of guys I went to school with didn't get a chance to do it. Like I said, it changed my perception of, yeah, who I was and what was possible. So the writing remained important, and I kept after it, and I wrote an award-winning play while I was on the Coast Guard, which was kind of fun.
Nice.
You know, the rejections, they were balanced out. You know, it gave me a little more balance to my life. And then about that time, I discovered, actually a Navy surgeon out of nowhere. We were talking about something else unrelated, and basically I was griping. And out of nowhere, he says, "Was your dad an alcoholic?" whoa. And he said, "Man, you might want to check out Al-Anon." So I started doing that, and I did Al-Anon very, probably 15 or 20 years pretty regularly. And that helped me, and that, again, kind of getting that clarity about who I really am versus the lies I told myself. And that was tough. We're all our harshest critic, but I was also my biggest underminer in a lot of ways. We take those external voices and we can internalize those. We can internalize those a lot. So Al-Anon helped me kind of clear away a lot of that stuff. And that definitely improved my writing. Because I think it gave me more distance, but I think again, it's just sort of that process of changing. I came to believe, through some other things, through some reading, that basically, well, there's a sociological maxim that people act as if the things they believe are true. So when I believed that I was worthless, unless I was undefined, successful writer, I acted like it was true. So therefore, if I was not successful, then I wasn't anything. Or that's what I told myself, and that's how I acted. Mm. Which was great for relationships, let me tell you. there's a reason Lisa's my third wife, but none of them have to do with those ladies. It was one of those lies I told myself, and it took me a while to sort of get out of it. But I was all this stuff's going on, but I'm still writing, and I'm still doing what I can. And I drifted into writing screenplays, because I always love movies. I think movies I love movies when I was a kid, and I came to look at them as like I believe movies are really powerful, because I think a really good one is like the closest thing to a shared dream we can have at this point in time. You get in a dark room with 500 people, you don't know 500 strangers, but a really good movie, you guys are going to have a very similar emotional experience. You can laugh together, gasp and cry. And I said, I also thought that was powerful. And so I like the idea of writing films for that magic. And so after the Coast Guard and after college, I ended up in California, and where we met. But prior to the time you and I met, I'd spent some time in Hollywood. I actually was a working writer in Hollywood for about a year. And this is all that. I guess if you pay attention, you can get some value out of this stuff. And a lot of the stories you hear about Hollywood are true. I mean, I've got my own completely cliche, but absolutely true Hollywood story, which was I sold a TV movie to Fox Television when they were still trying to do a lot of movies and stuff. And that was cool. It got me in the Writers Guild, which is the screenwriters union, which you need to belong to if you want to, write any big movies. And after 3 or 4 months, but after the time the check cleared, they fired the person at Fox TV who bought the project, and then they took his drawer full of projects and they dumped everything out. A lot of people in Hollywood say, "Yeah, that happened to me too." So that screenplay that won the award, Cold Day in Hell, was a good screenplay. And I feel pretty confident in saying that because we peddled it in Hollywood during the same time period. And it actually, in Hollywood, people have a lot more invested at the time, maybe it's changed now, but they have a lot more invested in saying no than they did saying yes. Because if you say yes and something's a flop, then your job's on the line. But if you say no, So it's a real gamble to say yes. So you've got to go through this hierarchy of, you know, you got to get through the readers and the mailroom and then this guy and then, you know, maybe the janitor's wife and on and on. Well, that screenplay went all the way to the president of Universal and he said no.
Oh,
that was a tough day, you know, because I had a manager at the time and he's telling me, man, you came as close as you can to selling a screenplay without actually doing it. And the problem was, that was really a good screenplay. And John Milius people sort of confirmed it for me 20 years later when I got that award. So I was out of money. I was a single dad at the time. My son was, I think, 5. And I had to like take stock of my life and go, well, okay. You know, I gave it a pretty good shot. You know, I didn't half-ass it. Kind of like with the rescue swimmer thing. I said, you know, I'd much rather die knowing I tried than to die wishing I had tried. So did the rescue swimmer thing. Cool. That worked out. Busted my ass on screenplays and everything, but now I got to get real. I just kind of set that aside. I worked as a substitute teacher during the day and I went to some classes at night and I started doing PC work to pay the bills. I kept writing. I even kept writing screenplays for a while, but then it just got to the point where I said, man, this is just, again, the structure of Hollywood. You write a screenplay and if it gets read by somebody or if they even like it, you have to go basically before this committee of 25-year-old MBAs who, you know, are low-level people in whatever organization, but they're going to give you notes. And I'm going to guess most of these people hadn't written much, but they knew what the current trend was, what the cliche was, what people were buying, you know, what thing they wanted it to be like, you know, can it be more like this? But I remember the thing that was sort of the scales falling from my eyes was when a guy who had read this award-winning screenplay, and it's about some POWs in the Korean War, and people told me they cried when they read it. So, yeah. But he said, you know, I need you to hold on for a little bit. I was like, yeah, why? Okay, sure, why? He said, I've got to go find out if it's okay to make the North Koreans the bad guys. And I'm thinking, dude, did you actually read the script? Do you have any idea what the Korean War really was and what was going on? So it was just, I said, man, I'm just kind of tired of this. I'm tired of that, that the MBA is like the death of 1,000 paper cuts. And I realized later too, I mean, this occurred to me in the last 5 years, you knock your brains out on a screenplay for 6 months, you know, whatever. And maybe you go through this whole process. And if you're lucky, 30, 40 people might read that. But at the time I said, man, I'm just tired of this. I'm just tired of this. And I had also had another epiphany. Very important, you know, that whole thing about, you know, if I wasn't a successful writer, I was nobody. And I said, you know, that's kind of a lie. I'm just going to write, you know, I'm a decent guy. I've never been in jail, you know. Smack the women's around or anything like that. And I just somehow let that lie go. I mean, it lingered, but the whole idea that if I wasn't successful, I was nothing. I'm like, I don't think so anymore. So I just sort of drifted in. You know, I've been a long time since I wrote a short story. And that was freeing when I just said, nope, I have a lot of value my value is just not is determined by more than whether I get a paycheck or make a living as a writer. And
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, Griff. I'm just so curious about your timeline here, because like when this sort of break in throwing your hands up in the air and saying, you know, goodness with everything. And then, you know, having to figure out a way to get a paycheck, take care of your kid, and then having this epiphany, like what were those years like? Because we heard about where you were at 25, and I'm in my 20s. So I'm really curious about this timeline right now.
Okay. 25, rescue swimmer, 27, 28, college, you know, 31 to 35, probably about 37 or 38 when I almost sold the screenplay. So it was about 3 years. You know, so there's sort of this 3 year period, and I was I got married to Lisa, and we were starting the whole blended family. I was driving LA traffic for an hour at least every day, each way. I still go on and stuff. So it was kind of in a 3 year period, and it was, I guess, a lot of, well, when you're driving for an hour at a time, you have a lot of time to reflect, and certainly like great prayer time. But like 37 to 40, I think, it was around 40 when that light just went off for me. I said,
I was saying that's a long time to sort of carry around that identity tie, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was really poisonous. Which is one reason I'm glad I got rid of it, but I'm a slow learner, apparently. I mean, it only took me until I was 40 to go, wow, you're just kicking yourself.
I was slower than that. So I was 48.
We get there when we get there, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and I think it depends on a lot of the, like you spoke about, like the childhood conditioning, right? Like those patterns that you get by the time you're 7 are so deep. It takes a long time to just even get to them when you're consciously working at them, let alone trying to make life work in the background. But, you know, there's also, I've called it in the Upside Down Messenger, I called it the messenger matrix, because there's like this, it's almost like an unconscious, you know, Jung's like collective unconscious. I imagine it being something like a really terrible subscription button that you accidentally punch before you walk out of the room, where you're like, I want to become a writer. And then you like click on this thing, but you don't know you're clicking on this thing, but it's almost like subscribing you to this. it's like a belief system. Mm-hmm. With the whole thing, like you don't even have to necessarily be in the webinars, talk to other writers or anything, just by virtue of saying, I want to be this thing. It's almost like you get all the baggage that comes with it. And this sure. idea of like, success looks like, you know, the top 1% of writers in yeah. Hollywood making bank, right? Like, who sets those? I love how you said that, the undefined success, because we have this conversation all the time around identity and success. Like, well, who told you needed that many zeros in your revenue line to be successful, or that many people in your retreats or your rooms in order to be successful? So.
Right. Yeah. I think a lot of us, you know, we work it out our own way. You know, I felt pretty invisible as a kid. People in their addictions, they sort of, their mm-hmm. attention goes elsewhere. But, and I think part of that was, you know, again, you know, part of, I think, what you're talking about, the baggage was, it was the idea, the identity of I'm a writer. So for a while, I think I was a lot more interested in that. You know, thinking, well, I got to do the things, you know, the pretty much the private press releases. I got to live the press release life. I got to go be John Steinbeck and get fights in the wharf and,
you know, Ernest Hemingway and, you know, Run with the Bulls and that kind of crap. But I was able to get away from that at a certain point, maybe because I enjoyed writing too much, but, you know.
I was kind of cracking up at the comment you made earlier about your chopped up bio, because we have a workshop that we recently did called a little therapy for your bio. And it was so therapeutic that it was a 2-hour workshop. And by the end of it, you know, we had just peeled the surface and we're like, okay, we're totally cracked open, you know, trying to sift through who we are and what we do. And then everything we've achieved in all these different aspects. And okay, when's the next workshop? The second half of the biotherapy, because it's like you said, it's so wrapped up in identities that are created from these lifelong stories that we might not even be aware of until 2 days ago, you know, a week ago.
Yeah, yeah, totally. You know, Griff, and there was a, yes, ma'am.
Looking back, do you feel like your writing, all the writing you did, helped you come to that awareness, like the therapy of writing, or?
Well, I'm sure it contributed. I think, you know, maybe because of my own background, my particular psychological makeup, I'm like, if you accept these things, I'm way out on some corner of the Myers-Briggs, you know, and also that 12-step stuff. I mean, I wish I had as much awareness now as I did when I was younger and had, you know, the energy to write, 12 hours a day. But I think it probably helped, at least as far as I was going, made me aware of shaping a story, you know, and collecting disparate elements to put into some kind of coherent whole that made sense. And I think eventually you put that together with the 12-step work and that kind of stuff. I think it helped prepare me to go, wait, I've done that with my life. You know, for a while there, my story was, child of an alcoholic and, you know, gang and all that kind of stuff. But that was just me taking some aspects of my life and packaging a story, as opposed to really being aware of the fact I was packaging that, and that was becoming my presentation of self. Separate, you know, that gap between the presentation and who I really was. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we've seen in the last few years, and like I said, I've written a tiny bit of fiction that blew my mind. It was just the epilogue for a novel that I'll write someday. But what I was trying to do in this was fictionalize a moment in time that I actually had. But there was something about the moment that I wrote about and the details that actually happened that I realized it was more true than my memory of the experience. So it was like, if I told the story, you know, I was in the middle of a labyrinth and I closed my eyes and I saw this vision of another labyrinth and right. And then I came back. But there was something that happened while I was writing. There was a woman who came. And she was like I called her the lady on the wind, and she was there and then she was gone. And I was like, I was not aware of her when I was having that moment, but you know what? That actually happened. It was a very strange thing. So, you know, that was kind of my first experience of seeing me putting myself into a story. There were stories that Aaron wrote when he was really little. That I was
unfortunately
like,
those aren't lost.
Those are not lost. They're kept in a file just in case you need therapy someday. But no, there were stories that he was writing, and I was like, oh shoot, he is working out some stuff. Like, you know, you could see the
this figure over here who looked a lot like this person in our life, and this person over here who looked a lot like, and I was thinking, oh, look, he's trying to sort his stuff out, even though he's 6 or 7, like he doesn't know what he's doing. And so what I think is awesome, while I'm listening to you share about this, because I had no idea about your background at all. Lisa hasn't shared any of these details, is that one of the things that she says about your writing is that you write relationships so well, like that you get such incredible props for like the love stories and the relationship dynamics of the characters in your book. So I love that like the origin story is invisible, can't figure out relationship, can't make that work. And now you're like delivering this beautiful art to the world that shows that you at least know what you're doing.
Well, we learn more from our failures, I think, than our easy successes. So
yeah,
that would be the relationship I'm referring to. Okay. Well, you know, it's funny when you talk about that thing appearing to you just writing that epilogue. And by the way, save that because, you know, I have to have an ending anyway before I start a book. I have a bazillion ideas that are just floating around, but I have to have a beginning and an ending. So you've got your ending, you know, you just read out your beginning, boom, you can write that. But what you're talking about that stuff appearing, one of the things that surprised me, because like I just sort of tripped into writing novels. The thing that started my first novel was just kind of an idea that, and I'm sure it's happened to Teddy and Lori and Alicia. It was so compelling. I saw it and I heard it and I felt it. So I just sat down and started writing and just wandering away with these guys. But the other thing about that I discovered over writing other novels, that first one became kind of a Rashomon sort of novel. It's told from a number of different perspectives, but my other ones since then have been pretty much straight through. When you describe that, the people showing up, I've written stuff and go, man, I didn't know I was that smart. You know, it just kind of shows up. And sometimes I go, I didn't know it was that funny. But I was thinking, as you were describing, I thought, wow, writing is sort of like the Enneagram of ourselves. You know, it's this mysterious, like, poof, oh man, I didn't know I hated cheese or whatever right. It is. It comes out, you know? But yes, that happens for me. Teddy, does that ever happen to you, ma'am? Oh, you were muted.
Oh, yeah. I love the wisdom that comes out in the writing and the like, whoa, I never even thought that before. Ah, oh, that was so powerful. Oh, where'd that come from? That was awesome. Yeah.
And it makes sense. Now I understand. Yeah. Stuff I wouldn't have known before. And I guess, Lori, I don't know, does that happen to you, ma'am?
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. What was go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. I was just going to ask about your son. I don't know how old he is now, but I just was curious if you ever did stories with him, and because I have this fun thing I do with my grandkids, and I always love stories. I too started writing when I was about 10, and so I'm just curious if that has seeped over into your son, or if you ever shared any story ideas with him, or you'd like
we have okay. When he was, 5 or 6, he drew a lot. And then he started telling stories in his little, you know, doing little comic books. And he would see me writing. And he'd tell his mom something like, I'm gonna write a story like Dad. And so I've saved, you know, some of these little stories he wrote about our cat, Fred, and, you know, the adventures they had and stuff. And as he's gotten older, he's got away from that, which I'm sad about, but I keep encouraging him to go back to it. He started a novel, which was really, it was a fantasy novel I thought was really unique. I hadn't seen anything like that before. And so, yes, we did. And I would tell him bedtime stories, we'd make up stories. And we have discussed one novel idea. Unfortunately, I have about 15 others I have to write. But we had this one idea that I thought would be fun to write together, called basically the idea is American myths, and it'd be more of a little bit of a social commentary on sort of the hidden myths that we have about people and places in America, and not you know, ooga booga Bigfoot type things, but I don't know. See, it's really amorphous, but we talked about it and we came up with some fun characters for it. So we may do that someday. He now, I live in Texas now. We moved from California about, 4.5 years ago. And my son's been out here about 3 years. And I'm really fortunate. In fact, we've been in plays together. So yes, ma'am, that's a great question. And I'm glad you're doing that with your grandchildren. And because I did it with my son and it was great.
Well, thank you. And thank you for your service.
I was young and it was fun. I got to be honest.
Just appreciate it.
Yeah.
I have to respond to what you were saying earlier, because I, about the things that come up when you're writing and you're like, oh, I didn't know that that was a thing for me. Or so I experienced that when I've sort of, because my fantasy novel, the first one is based on my true experience. So I wrote it raw the first draft through, and then I and like added a bunch of fiction and magic. And then I finally went through and kind of like named all the characters differently. And that for me was just a super pivotal like exercise. And I finally felt some disassociation from the characters. And then I could character build more. And I was able to bring them to life. And that was when I experienced all of the like, oh, where is this coming from? And how do I know that? And how do I, you know, like maybe, and then it would remind me of someone in my life. And I started associating, and it was quite therapeutic and fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened. But I'm really curious, because, you know, we've heard so much of your young life and struggles as a writer. And, you know, I'm 26. And so it's really good to hear all those things. But how did that feel?
Don't let me scare you off, really. I'm sure you'll be
no,
better.
There's a lot of resonance. You're not scaring me. You're actually giving me quite a lot of hope.
Okay.
So I'm really curious about when those things started pivoting for you. When you started, you know, experiencing your first successes with either books that you self-published, or when you started working with publishers, what was that transition like for you?
The first novel, like I said, it was just started as a short story. Very basically, the idea was something about what would happen. That's where all my, I don't really guys get your ideas. Mine are typically, I just sort of wander, you know, my mind wanders. I ask myself questions. I hear about something, or I see something, or I read something, and I'll just kind of say, wow, why did they do that? Or what would have happened if this, or how come somebody did that? And that's where almost everything I write comes from. And unless it's a funny line, and then I just you know, write that. But this one was just sort of thinking about the war on terror. Gosh, this was probably about 2005 or so, 2006. We're still doing the war on terror. And anyway, I've been thinking about it, and you know, there was a lot of differing opinions on it, and some of them were, you know, pretty vitriolic. And I was wondering, well, I mean, I believe Al-Qaeda when they say they want to destroy the West and trample us underfoot and, you know, and do what they do. They've given me plenty of evidence that that is, in fact, what they want to do and are trying to do. But there were a lot of people who said, you know, that was nonsense and we were imagining it and, you know, making it up, whatever. And I just wondered, well, what would have to happen to make these people change their minds? And that sort of became a whole... That became a three novel series, My Lonesome George Chronicles, imagining what would happen to America if Al-Qaeda had gotten their act together and hit us, you know, times, did some coordinated attacks at the same time. And in my imaginings, it sort of, you know, fractures the society, the social order, the culture, and leaves openings for invasion and things like that. So I just completely wrote that for myself. And because I was enjoying it mostly, I just said, oh, okay. So if this happened, what would the world look like? What would America look like? Well, you know, how would people react? And then I just started going again, just for myself. I was writing, mostly a short story, and people where I worked at the time knew I liked to write. So I started passing it out, and people were going, yes, I'm really enjoying this. Cool. I'll take that. So I write another chapter, and then I write another, and then I kind of finish the book. And then I just happened to run. Oh God, you're talking about my age now. It's probably about 50. I just happened to read something about a new publishing house that was coming up out of New York. They're going to publish more conservative things, and just not to get on too much of a rant, but as a reader, literary works don't thrill me. You know, I'm a story guy. I like to know what happens. I like to go on an emotional journey with people I can like or understand, and you know, and a lot of literature I've been exposed to was very much so what. You know, you get to the end of this road with some dreary people who had some dreary experiences and made some shit choices. And at the end, I'm going, so what? I don't care. You know, this did not ennoble me or lift me up or make me in any way a better person. And also, I guess I was like at a certain point going, dude, just don't do that. Don't make that choice. It's like blues, gut bucket blues. I can't listen to because it's let's see. I miss my baby so bad. I beats her and I cheats on her and she left me and I miss her. And I'm thinking, you're a moron. I don't want to listen to this. I don't want to spend any time with this. Make a different choice. But that's just me. So a lot of literature seemed to be invested in that. So I digress. So the kinds of things I was writing at the time would not be necessarily appealing to the big publishers. And I maybe tried one or two science fiction type, fantasy type publishers. But again, it had sort of a different point of view than a lot of their work. But these new guys were starting up in New York. Somehow I said, like, hey, send a short story in. So I sent them my first chapter. I sent them two short stories. One I'd written when I was about 22, and then this one I'd written when I was around 50. And I said, wow, we really like that one about the Lonesome George. You got any more? I said, well, yeah, actually, it's a whole book. So I sent it, and they said, hey, this will be our first book we publish. I went, cool.
Wow.
And fortunately, I'd gotten far enough away from all that all the illusions I had in my 20s. It was like, yeah, I'm not going to buy the Mercedes just yet. And it was a small publishing house, but the affirmation was nice. You know, that is kind of nice. I made, I think, tops $500 on three books. They were published. These guys were a new organization. They had a vision, but they didn't necessarily have a plan. So I'd written the first Lonesome George book, and I had this other idea that became By the Hands of Men, which was based on a story, again, that whole one, but based on a story an English woman told me when I was working we were doing one of my one-act plays. She was helping with the set. It's a lovely lady, older than me at the time. Probably my age now, but she seemed much older at the time. Tell me stories that her grandfather told her about being in World War I. And he said, the worst thing about being in the trenches was listening to the screaming of the wounded horses and not being able to do anything about it. There goes my wandering thing, which was, man, how could somebody listen to that and not try to do something? And that became sort of the beginning of this whole six book, the incident that sort of led me down the road to this whole six book, 500,000 word series. So I started writing that story because then the other part was one day, some other idea that really had no connection to it, kind of floated, and then I had this opening, and then they lined up. And I said, I've got a beginning and I've got an end. I think I'll start writing this. And my brain, I was thinking, oh, this is gonna be one book, I can, you know, but no, it didn't happen that way, because people started showing up and things started happening, and my characters did, you know, stupid stuff, but
without your permission, so, right?
Damn them, yes. They just, I was like having kids, you know? But, you know, I saw that kind of the struggles that the small publishers had. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's a whole different kind of genre. And people told me about self-publishing. So I decided to look into it. And that, that was sort of that became an educational learning experience in terms of, you can write a good book, but if nobody knows it exists, it's not going to get read. So I spent probably more time writing the books than really publishing, because there was a lot of research. I mean, I was going to mention this earlier. We're talking about the, you know, fiction, nonfiction. One of the things I recognize that fiction is lying, but I want to lie with a lot of truth in it. You know, I mean, certainly particularly for historical fiction. With my Lonesome George series, that was semi-contemporary. So I didn't have to do a lot of research unless it was on, you know, bomb making or something else like that. But the historical fiction, I wanted to have a feeling of verisimilitude. And it didn't want to be a treatise. We've all read those really thick honking novels that are like teaching you how to make soap out of the guts of a dead deer and stuff. Sort of interesting, but I'm not sure I really need to, 10 pages of that. What I found for me, probably as a reader, is something I like is I want to find the telling detail that may not be common knowledge, but it makes sense sort of in the context of the times, and you just go, oh, okay, that's right. It gives you a foothold, a reference in that time period without bludgeoning you with a dissertation on the Fabian movement in England or something. And there's a point to this, I swear. So so I self-published the first book and I kept writing books. And the few people who did read it, they liked it. And that was enough to make me keep going, because I decided I'm just gonna write for myself. I mean, I've written for free for so long, it shouldn't matter now if I'm continuing to write for free. I was kind of working where I do, I did By the Hands of Men, then I started working on the next Lonesome George book. And when that was done, I started working on the next By the Hands of Men book, and I still saw where it went. But it probably, I think the first one was published in 2013 or 2014. It probably took me until about 2019 to say, you know, enough people have told me, not that many, but the ones who read it really liked it. They either like it or it's just not for them. And that's fine. Somebody said, yeah, why don't you look at marketing? So I did. And then, I had learned a skill set, because I don't think I'm very skilled at it. But I learned a few things I could do. And so I started marketing it. And by then the other company had folded and, you know, I got my rights back to the three books. And it was fine. Because I wrote the book and I was happy with the Lonesome George series and how it turned out. But I was even happier to discover I could write different things. I mean, I think I can't remember if I told you this before, but the reason I felt like I didn't have a real writing career was I didn't write the same thing all the time. You know, I'm not the vampire werewolf harem guy who writes 20 books about that. When I was in the Coast Guard, they asked me to write something for the family newsletter. So I wrote a children's story called His Amphibian Hood, about a prince who thinks he's a frog. And, people liked it, turned into a great little one act play. And then people were like, when are you gonna write your next children's story? Like, I already wrote one, so I'm gonna write something else. And this one happens to be about a merchant seaman who comes home after being gone for 6 months to find out his wife is dead and nobody told him. And he has to go find the vampire that killed his wife. Because it interested me, or something about it, like so. But I discovered I liked writing the Lonesome George books, and I'm probably glad they weren't a raging success because I might be expected to write more. And I don't want to write those the rest of my life. By Hands of Men, a lot of fun, and it was a great creative exercise because my wife is outside. She may be saying goodbye. She's going to something. It told me I could really write something different. And if y'all get a chance to check it out, I welcome your comments. But like, for instance, By the Hands of Men, one of the things I decided to do, and I didn't realize why, but it's going to be later. I think I need the creative challenge. That's the other reason I can't write 20 books of the same kind over and over, because I kill myself with boredom. One of the things I wanted to do with the historical fiction was, I thought, you know, I want to write this as if it was published contemporaneously with the events of the story. So that created this really cool challenge for me, which I think helped keep me interested and help me develop some different creative muscles. So that means, you know, there's no skin, there's no boinking, very little, you know, cursing, and certainly no wild outbursts of profanity. But it forced me to come up with a different writing style, and even the way I would describe things, and, you know, vocabulary, word choice, sentence structure. So it's like you're reading almost reading a biography of these people as if it had been published during their lives, which gives it, I think, it gives it a different tone. It's a different kind of reading experience for people. But to go back to the original question, which was asked probably 15 minutes ago, you know, it was freeing. I had the published book, and yeah, so now I can say I'm a professionally published author with who knows how many, you know, how many tens of copies were sold. And then, you know, the self-publishing was kind of educational, but it was almost a secondary thing for about the first 5 years. It was more important to me to finish the books, the series. Mm-hmm. But here in the last 3 or 4 years, when people are getting to know it, that's really gratifying. You know, I've made a little money on it. I bought this ring. That was a big deal. It's like my ring with a Coast Guard insignia on it. I would put on this hand, but my wife would have something to say about that. But I made a lot of money. But what is really cool is I get emails from readers. You know, I've gotten emails from people in Australia and England and Canada. They're really, nobody's written me hate mail. They're really nice emails from people saying how much they enjoyed the book. And, you know, maybe it reminded them of the story of how their grandmother met his husband, or, you know, how it took them back, or whatever, or how much they just liked it. You know, I'm an 84-year-old woman in Australia, and I don't get out much, but I really liked your stories, and, you know, whatever. That is cool. Lisa, did I answer your question? I was just, you know, I'm sorry. I'm just rambling on there.
You did. Yes, you did. Okay. Yeah. I actually am not sure if I drew us over time with that question, but I have so many more questions, especially with just a lot of the places that you were talking about as an earlier writer. We'll just have to have you on for another episode.
If the audience demands it, I'm there.
There you go. Yeah, no, this has been wonderful. And I'm really glad that we started with the origin story, because, you know, that is a lot of what we are looking at True to Intention and Saved by Story is, you know, stories come through us for a reason. And sometimes I love that your big breakthrough happened when you're like, no, I'm doing this just for me. Like, because I love it, because it nourishes me, and kind of broke the link between, you know, I have to get this sort of acknowledgement or this sort of paycheck or this sort of thing. And that it became something else and something more once you did that, because I have seen that over and over. And people, you know, I've always said that it's like this bait and switch that God or the universe does with us. You know, it's like, go change the world. And we get this great idea to do something. And then we get right into the middle of it. We're like, oh crap, this is really about me. Like this character that I'm writing looks very familiar, or, you know, this block that I'm talking, trying to help people through, I'm suddenly facing it again. Right. So I'm just glad that you started out there and shared that part of your story. And I do think there's a lot more to have. I would love to hear even more about your creative process and that idea of like when the characters show up and what happens when they don't, and, you know, what does your writer's block look like and all of that fun. So am I hitting some of those questions you have on your list, Lisa? So we'll do it again. But in the meantime, how do our listeners, viewers get a hold of your books? Where can you send them so that they can learn more about you and find some of your work?
Well, all my books, all my currently published books are on Amazon. My you can look me up as Roy M. Griffiths. That's M like Madison, G-R-I-F-F-I-S. I also have a webpage, roymgriffiths.com. Yeah, that's the two primary places. I'm also on Facebook. It's Roy M. Griffiths Storyteller.
Nice. Well,
yeah. And the website, you can send me an email if you want. I love hearing from people. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet that is extremely rewarding.
Really cool.
Yeah. We're doing a series for A Religion of Story right now, where we're listening to some of our readers share what their experience is, and we're recording it for future readers. And it's been one of those, like, I imagine a similar moment of hearing the impact in real time. So,
yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, for sharing your story, and for agreeing to come back. And and I want to thank all of our listeners for listening to this episode of Sips of Story and Sanity. If you like what you heard, please go check out Griff's work and consider subscribing, leaving us review, and maybe even sharing a moment that you had where a character just showed up and blew your mind. but you can find more details at truetointention.com and savedbystory.house. All right, that's a wrap for today. Thanks. Okay.